The Book of Enoch, Chapter 91. After journeying through the heavenly realm and returning to Earth, Enoch is preparing to be taken back up into the heavens once again.
What if the Bible you have trusted your entire life is not the full story? Not accidentally incomplete, but deliberately reduced. High in the mountains of Ethiopia, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church preserved something most of the world never saw. An ancient 81-book Bible with a different structure entirely. Inside it are texts filled with visions of layered heavens and shocking descriptions of Jesus that do not fit the known version.
Can people really see the future? Receive messages from across time and space? For centuries, seers and prophets.
Now, as Mel Gibson, the director behind The Passion of the Christ, moves forward with a long-awaited sequel, he has come across something buried in those very texts. What he just uncovered about Jesus is not a small discovery. It will change everything you thought you knew about him. Two empires, two Bibles. Mel Gibson started with a problem. While preparing his next film about the resurrection, he began digging into early Christian material that most people never read. Not for curiosity, but because something in the standard version of the story did not feel complete. And the deeper he went, the more that feeling turned into something clearer. There were parts missing, entire sections of the story that existed in some places and not in others. And that trail does not lead to Rome. It leads somewhere most people never think to look. In the book of Acts, there is a moment that is easy to overlook, but it changes how this entire story begins. A powerful official from Ethiopia is traveling alone on a desert road. This is not just a traveler. He serves under the Kandake, the queen of the Aksumite kingdom. Kandake is not a name. It is a title, like Pharaoh or Caesar. This man holds real authority. And yet he is sitting in a moving chariot, reading from a scroll of Isaiah, trying to understand it. Then something happens that should not be treated as small. An apostle named Philip sees him, runs alongside the chariot, and speaks to him. The conversation ends with him accepting the message of Christ. This is not a later story added over time. It is written directly into the New Testament in the book of Acts, which means something very clear. One of the earliest recorded people to receive the Christian message was a high-ranking official from Ethiopia. From the very beginning, before any councils, before any decisions about what books would stay or go, Ethiopia was already inside the story. And that is where the numbers start to matter. Because today the Protestant Bible has 66 books, the Catholic Bible has 73. Eastern Orthodox churches include even more. And the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church recognizes 81 books as scripture, 15 additional books. So now the question becomes unavoidable. If Ethiopia was there from the beginning and still holds a larger version of the story, why is the version most people were given the shorter one? Let's move forward a few centuries. In the 4th century, King Ezana of Aksum officially converted his empire to Christianity. Around the same time, Emperor Constantine did the same in Rome. Two powerful empires, same century, same faith, but they do not end up with the same Bible. One tradition settled on a shorter collection, the other kept more. That split has never been fully explained, and when you start comparing what each side kept, the difference becomes uncomfortable. Ethiopia preserved books that most people have never even heard of. First Enoch, Jubilees, the Ascension of Isaiah, the Shepherd of Hermas, Ethiopian Maccabees, and these texts change how the entire system works. Take the Book of Jubilees. In this version, angels are not distant figures sitting somewhere far away. They are directly involved in what is happening with human beings. It describes moments where angels are physically present when agreements between God and humans are made, almost like witnesses making sure everything is followed exactly. And the conditions are not vague. For example, Jubilees says that if someone knowingly breaks the Sabbath, they are to be cut off from their people, meaning removed from the community and treated as if they no longer belong. In some cases, the punishment goes further and is described as death. That is very different from how most people understand it today. So this is not just an expanded version of Genesis. This is a world where heaven is actively managing what happens on earth in a very direct and strict way. Now look at how this tradition explains the origin of evil. Most people grow up with a simple version from the Bible. A serpent appears, speaks to Eve, she disobeys God, and that act brings sin and suffering into the world. But the Ethiopian tradition, especially in texts like Enoch, describes something much more organized. Specific beings, called watchers, come down to earth on purpose. The text gives their names like Semjaza and Azazel. They agree to leave their assigned place in heaven where they were supposed to remain and enter the human world even though they were not allowed to. Their goal is clear. They want to live among humans, take human wives, and share knowledge that was not meant for people. And when they come down, they do not come empty-handed. One of them, Azazel, teaches humans how to make weapons. Swords, knives, shields, armor. Think about that. Warfare is not something humans slowly figure out. It is introduced. Other beings teach how to work with metals, how to manipulate materials, how to use knowledge in ways that give control. At the same time, they introduce things like altering appearance, feeding into vanity and comparison. So what is taken is innocence, the original state where humans did not operate this way. What is lost is the boundary between heaven and earth, that clear separation that once existed. And what enters the world is something new. Violence that spreads fast. Corruption that does not stay contained. The text is very direct about this. Human evil was taught. It was structured. It was brought in from outside. Now you start to see why these books still exist. Ethiopia was protected by more than distance. Deserts, mountains, and unstable trade routes made it extremely difficult for outside powers, especially the Roman Empire and its church authorities, to reach and control what was happening there. So when church leaders began removing certain books elsewhere, those decisions never reached Ethiopia. No orders, no councils, no forced changes. While others were cutting the story down, Ethiopia kept everything, and the monks went to extreme lengths to protect it. Some memorized entire books word for word so that even if the manuscripts were destroyed, the text would still survive in their minds. Others wrapped the manuscripts in cloth, climbed narrow cliff paths with nothing but a rope in their hands, pulling themselves up sheer rock faces where one slip meant falling to their death just to hide those texts in places no army could reach. So now you are left with something difficult to ignore. One church, in one part of the world, held on to a version of this story that everyone else slowly reduced. And what that version contains is not just different. It is more detailed, and in some places it is far more unsettling than what most people have ever read, which leads to a very strange discovery. One of those missing books is actually quoted inside the Bible most people own. It is referenced directly, but it was never allowed to stay. The book that was left out, but never left. The book of Jude sits quietly near the end of the New Testament, and most people read past it without noticing anything unusual. But then you reach Jude 1:14, 15, and something stops you. It says, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment on all." This is not just a random statement. It is taken from 1 Enoch chapter 1. A passage describing God arriving with countless heavenly beings to judge the world and expose all wrongdoing. That means a book that is missing from most modern Bibles is still being quoted inside them. So now the question becomes unavoidable. How can a book be important enough to be quoted as scripture, but not important enough to be included? Now go back to Genesis. Enoch appears for a moment and then disappears. One line says he walked with God and then God took him. No detail, no explanation. But first Enoch takes that silence and fills it with something very specific. It describes Enoch being taken up and shown visions of heaven, where he sees structured layers of the universe. He is shown where the winds come from, where the sun and moon move in fixed paths, and where the stars are kept under command. He also describes encounters where he stands before divine beings, who explain what is happening on earth and why judgment is coming. Another area scholars keep coming back to is what the text reveals about events on Earth. In that section, it describes how, after the Watchers came down, they had children with human women. These children are called the Nephilim. They are described as massive, destructive, and impossible to control. They consume resources, turn against humans, and fill the Earth with chaos. This is where First Enoch becomes very direct about the Flood. In Genesis, the Flood is described as a response to general wickedness. In Enoch, it is a targeted response. The Nephilim are the problem. The Flood is not just punishment, it is a reset, meant to remove what should not have existed in the first place. That is a very different explanation. Then another detail starts to stand out. First Enoch describes a scene where Azazel, one of the Watchers, is seized, bound, and thrown into darkness to wait for judgment. When scholars compare that to the Book of Revelation, they notice how similar the language is when Satan is bound and cast into a pit. The structure of the scene is almost identical, and since Enoch was written first, it raises a question that has never been fully answered. How much of what appears in the New Testament is building on ideas from texts that were later left out? And this is where something much bigger starts to emerge, something that changes how you see Jesus. Inside First Enoch, there is a figure called the Son of Man. He is not described as someone who will suddenly appear without context. He already exists before the final judgment. He is placed on a throne. He has authority over kings and nations. He is the one who will judge the world. These descriptions appear in texts dated between the 1st and 2nd century BCE, long before the time of Jesus. Now, when scholars look at the Gospels, they notice something important. Jesus repeatedly calls himself the Son of Man. And according to many biblical scholars, it suggests that Jesus is stepping into an already existing identity, one that people in that time would have recognized from texts like Enoch. So the truth that begins to emerge is this. Jesus was aligning himself with a role that had already been described in detail before he was born. And if that sounds like something that could have been added later, the Dead Sea Scrolls removed that possibility. In 1947, a teenage boy threw a rock into a cave and heard something break. Inside are clay jars. Inside those jars are ancient scrolls. Among them are multiple copies of First Enoch, written in Aramaic, dating back to before the time of Christ. And here is the detail that makes it even more striking. Those caves are less than 2 miles from where John the Baptist was preaching. That means these ideas were present in the same environment where the earliest Christian message began. These are the kinds of texts Mel Gibson encountered when he began looking beyond the standard version of the story. And the deeper he went, the clearer it became that the version he had grown up with was not the full picture. Enoch shows you who Jesus was before the world began. But another text goes even further. The Unseen Descent. There is another early Christian text that goes even further. It does not just describe who Jesus was. It describes how he actually entered the world. It is called the Ascension of Isaiah, and it does not begin the way you would expect. It begins with an execution. The prophet Isaiah is taken by men carrying out the orders of a king who saw him as a threat and wanted him silenced. They force him inside a hollow tree and cut him in half while he is still alive. According to early Christian tradition recorded in this text, this was not random violence. Isaiah had been describing a vision he claimed to have seen, a vision where a figure would descend from heaven, pass through unseen realms, and enter the human world. That message was dangerous. It suggested that the power ruling the world was not final and that something greater was moving through it without being detected. Once those in power understood what he was claiming, they saw him as a threat, so they did not just stop him. They made sure his voice could never spread. Before that death, Isaiah had seen something. The text described him being lifted upward through a structured series of heavens. There were 7 distinct levels. Each one was different from the one below it. The higher he moved, the more ordered and intense everything became. The beings in those levels existed within a system, each level operating with its own structure and authority. Then the vision shifted. Isaiah witnessed a figure described as the Beloved begin moving downward. and this was where everything changed. As the Beloved passed through each level, he did not reveal himself. He took on the appearance of the beings in that level. When he entered a realm of angels, he looked like one of them. When he moved further down, he continued to blend in. No one recognized him. Not a single being in any of the seven heavens understood who was moving through their space. He passed through each level undetected until he reached the earth, where he was born as a human. This was not presented as a peaceful arrival. The lower levels were not safe or empty. They were controlled. The text says Satan and his forces were active there, operating in the space between heaven and earth. So when the Beloved descended, he was not just moving freely. He was passing through territory that was already occupied. And the only reason he made it through was because he was not recognized. If they had known who he was, the text suggests they would have stopped him. And this changes how the world below is understood. The text does not treat what happened on Earth as just human decisions made by leaders and governments. It connects those decisions to the same forces operating in the lower heavens. That means the system ruling the world at the time of Jesus was not acting on its own. It was being influenced from above. So when laws were enforced, when power was exercised, when someone like Jesus was judged and executed, the text suggests those actions were happening inside a system that was already under that influence. Rome, in this view, was not just a political empire making its own choices. It was part of a larger structure, one that was tied to those forces and operating within their control. So when you step back and look at what this text is describing, the truth becomes very clear. Critics now argue that Jesus did not simply appear in Bethlehem as the beginning of the story. He had already moved through a hidden structure, in disguise, unrecognized, passing through layers that were not under his control. The birth was not the start. It was the final step of a descent that no one saw happening. Then the direction reversed. After his death, the same figure began moving upward again. But this time there was no disguise. As he passed through each level, every being recognized him. Each being acknowledged him as he moved upward. This was not just a return to life. It was a complete reversal of what had happened before. He had descended unnoticed. He ascended fully revealed. This is the kind of structure Mel Gibson had been pointing toward when he said the resurrection story was much bigger than what is written in the Gospels. He had spoken about layers, about unseen parts of the story that had never been shown. The ascension of Isaiah matched that description almost exactly. It did not replace the Gospels. It filled in what they left out, showing what happened in the space between. The moment you see all of this together, the question becomes unavoidable, and it is not a comfortable one. Who decided what belongs in the Bible, and who decided what does not? The canon was debated. At the beginning, there was no fixed New Testament. Some early Christian communities read Enoch. Some read texts like the Ascension of Isaiah. Others followed different collections of writings. So the Bible, as people know it today, did not drop into place fully formed. It was built over time, and that process involved real decisions made by real people. And this is the same problem Mel Gibson ran into as he started digging deeper. The more sources he explored, the more it became clear that the version most people were given was only part of a much larger picture. One of the earliest and most disruptive figures in this process was a man named Marcion. He lived in the second century, and he did something no one had done before. He created the first known official list of Christian texts. But his version was shocking. He rejected the entire Old Testament and claimed that the God described there was different from the one Jesus spoke about. That forced the early church into a corner. They had to respond. They had to define what was acceptable and what was not. So the formation of the Bible was not just about preserving truth. It was also a reaction to ideas that were seen as dangerous. From there, the process became more structured. By the 4th century, church leaders began to formalize what would become the New Testament. In 367 CE, a bishop named Athanasius listed the 27 books that now make up the New Testament. Later councils, like those at Hippo and Carthage, reinforced that list. But these were not quiet or purely spiritual discussions. These were debates with consequences. Different groups supported different texts. Some argued strongly for books like Enoch. Others rejected them. And once decisions were made, they did not stay theoretical. This is where the darker side of the process comes in. There is historical evidence that some texts were not just left out. They were actively destroyed. Writings that did not align with what became official teaching were targeted. Copies were burned. Possession of certain texts could become dangerous. And this process unfolded under the authority of powerful leaders. The Council of Nicaea in 325 CE, for example, was called by Emperor Constantine. This was a ruler with political power, a man who had ordered executions, including members of his own family. And yet he was deeply involved in shaping the direction of Christian belief. Critics have raised unsettling questions as a result of this. How much influence did political power have over what became scripture? And then discoveries in modern times complicate things even further. In 1945, near Nag Hammadi in Egypt, a collection of ancient texts was found buried in jars. Among them was the Gospel of Thomas. It contains 114 sayings attributed to Jesus, many of which do not appear in the four Gospels people are familiar with. But what stands out is the kind of Jesus it presents, not one focused on building a church or establishing authority, but one who speaks about finding truth within yourself, about hidden knowledge, and about awakening to something already inside you. In this version, Jesus is not leading people into a system. He is pointing them inward, and that is a very different direction. This text was not proven false. It was simply not included. And this is exactly the kind of shift someone like Mel Gibson has been circling, a version of Jesus that feels bigger, deeper, and less controlled than the one most people were handed. So that raises another question. Was it excluded because it was inaccurate, or because it presented a version of Jesus that did not fit the structure being built? And as Gibson has hinted in interviews, there may be parts of that story that were never meant to stay hidden, only delayed. And that leads to a much sharper question. If texts like Enoch and the Ascension of Isaiah were once read, debated, and in some cases deliberately removed, then the issue is no longer just what they say. The issue is what happened to them after they were pushed out, because not everything was destroyed. Some of it survived. The monasteries. Some of these texts were taken somewhere else and kept alive in ways that are hard to imagine. They were hidden in remote and dangerous places far in the mountains. There were moments in history where invaders entered these regions and targeted religious sites directly. Churches were looted, sacred objects were taken. Manuscripts that had survived for hundreds of years were carried away or destroyed. And yet, even in those moments, the response from the monks was escalation. They hid texts deeper. They split collections. Some carried them further into isolated areas where no army could follow. And then something happened that proved just how important this preservation was. When scholars finally gained access to some of these manuscripts and began testing them, the results did not match expectations. The Garima Gospels, kept in an Ethiopian monastery, were tested at Oxford. The assumption was that they would date to the medieval period, but the results came back much earlier, between 390 and 570 CE. That made them some of the oldest surviving complete Christian manuscripts in the world. Older than many texts preserved in Europe. Older than what most people assumed even existed in complete form. But that discovery only scratched the surface. There are still thousands of manuscripts in Ethiopia that have never been fully studied or even cataloged. Some scholars believe that among them could be earlier versions of texts that later appeared in edited form elsewhere. That means what is sitting in those monasteries may not just be additional material. It could be closer to the original versions of the story itself, and no one knows for sure because much of it has never been fully examined. Then came one of the darkest recent moments. During the Tigray conflict, monasteries and churches were attacked again. Thousands of manuscripts were looted, some were destroyed, others appeared for sale online for small amounts of money. Priests and caretakers were killed. Entire collections that had survived for over 1,000 years were suddenly at risk of disappearing in a matter of months. And this is where the connection becomes impossible to ignore. The texts that describe the kind of story Mel Gibson has been talking about, the layered heavens, the hidden descent, the movement through unseen realms, were not preserved in Rome. They were not protected by large institutions with global reach. They survived in places like this, in the hands of people who risked their lives to keep them intact. So when Gibson began describing a version of the story that goes beyond what the Gospels show, he was not inventing something new. He was moving towards something that had already been written and protected for centuries. And now, for the first time in history, someone with a global audience and a proven ability to make the world stop and pay attention was preparing to take that version of the story and bring it into the open. What Mel Gibson found. Before any of this, you have to understand who Mel Gibson is. Not the director, the man. He went through a very public collapse, alcohol abuse, shameful arrests, a recorded outburst that ended his career almost overnight and made him untouchable in Hollywood. Studios backed away, doors closed. And then in 2004, he did something no one expected. He made The Passion of the Christ. No major studio supported it. He funded it himself. And it went on to make over $600 million worldwide. A man pushed out of the system created one of the most successful religious films ever made. And now, he was not trying to repeat that. He was trying to go further. What he started building next was not a simple continuation. He became focused on one specific part of the story, the resurrection, but not the visible part, the space between death and rising. What happened in that gap? What happened in the unseen? He described it in interviews as something people had never seen before, something much bigger than the version most people were familiar with. And that language matters, because it lines up directly with the texts you have just seen. Then he said something even more direct. He said modern Christianity had been sanitized, stripped down, made safer than it originally was, and he used one word to describe what had been removed: terror. Not fear in a simple sense, but something overwhelming, something that stops you completely. That is important because the texts preserved in Ethiopia do not avoid that feeling. They describe occupied heavens, active forces, hidden movement, judgment, destruction. They are not comfortable. And that is exactly what Gibson said had been taken out of the story. Now connect that to something most people have said without thinking about it. The Apostles' Creed. One of the oldest statements of Christian belief. Inside it is a line that is repeated by millions. He descended into hell. Most people say it and move on, but Gibson stopped there. Because in the tradition of the ascension of Isaiah and in the theology preserved in Ethiopia, that line is literal. It describes an actual movement through a real structure, through darkness, through layers, through territory that is not empty. And that is exactly the kind of story Gibson has been building toward. And he has already shown he is willing to carry the consequences of telling a version of the story people are not comfortable with. When The Passion of the Christ was released, it was immediately attacked. Critics said it was dangerous, that it pushed boundaries that should not be pushed. He did not change it. He released it as it was, and audiences showed up, which proved something important. The version of the story that creates the most tension is the one people cannot ignore. And what he is building now goes even further than that. Because when you take everything together, the texts, the descent, the structure, the hidden movement, something very specific emerges. Not just a different version of events, but a different identity. And this is what Gibson's exploration leads to. Not just what happened to Jesus, but what he was operating as inside that system. The ascension of Isaiah described a descent where he was not recognized at any level. He moved through each layer without being identified, and that pattern does not suddenly stop when he reaches the world. It continues. The system he entered, the one influencing earthly power, did not fully recognize who had entered it. The Roman authority carried out the execution. The religious leaders pushed for it. But according to this structure, they were acting inside something already under influence. And that system did not see him clearly. That is the truth this points to. Because it means the crucifixion was not just an act of resistance against him. It was carried out inside a system that could not fully see what had entered it. Not because he was weak, but because he was operating on a level beyond it. And that is the part that strengthens the story, not weakens it. Because if the system that controlled the world could not recognize him, then it means he was never truly under its control. He moved through it. He was judged by it. He was killed within it. But he was never defined by it. And that is exactly what the resurrection proves. The books survived. The monks protected them. What could be destroyed was destroyed. What could not be reached remained. Mel Gibson found it. And when he brings it to the screen, it will not just show a different version of Jesus. It will reveal something much harder to ignore. If even the system that killed him could not fully understand him, then he was never just part of it. He was real.